Hey everybody, before I start the show, I just wanted to give thanks and a shout out to my first patrons. My Patreon is live, there's a link for it in the show notes if you would like to help out the show. I'd like to say thank you to my new stone dogs. I have Master of the Deck. Thank you, Master of the Deck. I have Rob from Malkier Talks. Thank you, Rob, you're awesome. DT. If anybody's ever gone to Watt Trivia and Games, DT runs that server, and it's really great. And Holly T. Thank you very much, Holly T. You are awesome. Thank you, Stone Dogs. And I have one new Night Spear, Leafcast, Brother Dan. He is my new Night Spear, and he is great. So I would like to thank these fine people and puppets. In the case of Dan, Dan is a puppet. I really appreciate your help. It's super awesome, and yeah, it's great. It means a lot to me. It was really nice to just start the Patreon and immediately have people basically jump out of the woodwork to help me. I appreciate you all very, very much. So, thank you.
The stone won't fall until the podcast of the dragon comes to your device. Hey everybody, my name is Morgan. You might know me as the Grey Warder on Twitter and Discord. Welcome to episode 19, Podcast of the Dragon. They're an incompetent snarl of evil that's unleashed on the world of Rantland, and they're definitely up to something nefarious. Let's stop and take a look at Five Forsaken and dive deep into what they're doing in the Dragon Reborn and revel in all of their murderous, devious glory. Think about the glory.
The thing about having a topical Wheel of Time podcast is that it can be really difficult to decide how to do a book like The Dragon Reborn, how to break it down and do the topics that I want to do in an order that makes sense. Because I'm structuring my episodes around a single book or a single section of the story, I can't just approach them willy-nilly like putting them in a hat and just plucking them out whichever. I'm making use of the story to draw inspirations for episodes, so it follows that I should hold to the structure of the narrative when figuring out where they belong in a sequence. Some books are just easier. It was easy to do The Eye of the World and take it in a fairly linear fashion. I struggled at the beginning of The Great Hunt because I had a whole tangle of ideas that I thought was one episode, but when I sat down and when I worked it all out, I realized, no, I have three episodes here. And that was why there were three episodes clustered at the beginning of The Great Hunt. And then I just kind of moved into the middle of the book following events, and then just finished it up at the end in a logical fashion, because studying Rand's daddy issues culminates nicely with him accepting that he's the dragon and declaring himself at the end, so it worked fairly well. It was linear enough and a good bit of back and forth, but the order I felt like worked pretty well. The problem with this book is that while with the episodes that I'm looking at, whether it's studying individual characters or looking at relationships or events, it's relatively simple to arrange them in a temporally logical fashion. Each and every theme or event that can be explored in The Dragon Reborn has something affecting it, brewing in the background or beneath the surface or sometimes right in front of your face. The activity going on throughout The Dragon Reborn, and you get it in the first and second book, but just not to the degree of sophistication that you do in this one, is what I like to call, quite simply, forsaken fuckery. And so I finally decided that the easiest way to have my episodes in The Dragon Reborn make the most sense, with the least explanation of background machinations bogging down the points I really want to make, is just to break down the Forsaken fuckery in this episode, because there is so much of it going on here. And honestly, it is one of the most engaging things about the Third Wheel of Time book. We meet three new Forsaken in Samael, Belal, and Raven. This exposes us to all of these different motivations, different villain story arcs, and different types of personalities. We've been hearing about the Forsaken for two whole books at this point, so to be able to meet more is really kind of exciting, even when we don't actually meet them. Like, we never meet Samael in this book, but we get an impression of his personality, even in what we don't see. And we don't know which Forsaken that Lord Gabriel actually is, and we don't even know for certain that he's Forsaken, but you can infer it based upon the things that you overhear him say, and the general theme in the book of, this new person is in charge, and gee, they end up being a Forsaken. If the new guy on the Council of Nine in Ilion is a Forsaken, and the new High Lord in Tyr is a Forsaken, it stands to reason that this new lord no one has heard of who's got Morghese's ear in Camelon is probably a Forsaken too. So we don't know which Forsaken Gabriel is until Book 5, and we barely meet Belal before Moraine zorches him with Balefire, but seeing these ancient evil entities kind of settle down to engage in political intrigues rather than just raining destruction, because a lot of times when you think of magical boss-level bad guys in stories, they come out to kill and destroy, to rain spells of fire and lightning and terror and release their murderous armies. They don't settle down to a much more, on one hand, boring but on the other hand fascinating desk job. It's like taking a fantasy trope and making a parody of it. Like, my evil lieutenants are going to work in admin. They're not going to kill everyone. They're going to sit down and dig into the meat and potatoes of current-day Randland politics. It makes them interesting. Before The Dragon Reborn, we've had a decent bit of interaction with the Forsaken, but it's been relatively clear-cut. We have two books at this point where we have had all this exposure to Ashamael, who we don't yet know is Ashamael. We learn that at the end of this book. But we had this dark, mysterious figure with fire eyes who calls himself Baalzamon, and it's just, Mwahaha, I'm confusing. Am I the Dark One? Am I not? Here I am haunting your dreams. Join me or die. I have won again, Luce Theron. Mwahaha. At the end of The Eye of the World, we meet Aghanor and Balthamel, and they're in really bad shape. They've just gotten out of jail, they're not looking so great, they reek of stale boar, and their first stop is the all-you-can-channel power buffet, and they're, you know, we are bound no longer. I mean, Balthamel doesn't say shit because he can't, but it's just, like Ishmael, we walk the world again, and the rest of us will come. Mwahaha. Just lots of mwahaha. To give us a little bit of a different spin on Forsaken Evil, in The Great Hunt, Lanfear the Creepy Cougar shows up, and she, rather than being a lot of mwahaha, is being quite helpful. She's more interesting because you don't just get her blatant evil and diabolicalness. Instead, it seems like her game is very gray. She provides enough aid that you can't say for sure that she means Rand harm in a direct way. But you also know that she kidnapped him, even if he's like, I don't understand how I got in this world, it must be my fault. You know, it's so obvious that she kidnapped him. It's so obvious that she's a creep and she's predatory, which makes her almost scarier than someone who's like, I will kill you and steal all the power. Serve me or die, mwahaha. There's something realistic about Lanfear's evil. As much as someone who lived 3,000 years ago and then was stuffed into the borehole of their evil master and sealed in can be realistic. She's just obsessive and creepy and stalkerish, and that's compelling in a way that the more posturing, villainous monologuing type Forsaken are not. I can't go any further into a discussion of the Forsaken in The Dragon Reborn without touching on dreams and dreaming. And while I'm not going to go very in-depth on dreams in this book, I feel like it's best to wait until The Shadow Rising, when Egwene starts training and Perrin really begins learning the wolf dream before I do that, I've got to mention them, because we've been seeing dreams and the fact that RJ finds dreams very significant since book one. And one of the reasons that we have been exposed to them and that dreams have made themselves clear to us and to the characters is because the Forsaken make use of them. Ishamael / Baalzamon haunts the boys in dreams, and the world of dreams is a staging place or a platform. It is a medium that the Forsaken understand, and they move through it and use it to communicate with each other. They use it to pull their followers in for quick meetings, and they use it to torment and punish and to kill. It's important, and now we're beginning to see why. What felt strange and random in book one is, now that we're getting so much more of it, showing itself to be significant and an essential part of the narrative. The unseen world is becoming seen. Instead of just creepy, haunty dreams, we're getting dreaming with intent. People are using dreams to communicate. At this point, RJ is using it for foreshadowing. He's got this wonderful medium with dreams to foreshadow a fuck ton of stuff and tell us all kinds of info and not have to use any exposition whatsoever. It's fucking brilliant. Having Perrin and Egwene both be dreamers, letting Perrin have access to visions and tell around Riad, and having Egwene's inner narrative full of all the confusing dreams she's having where she just lays them all out, this gives us pictures that are worth a thousand words. They offer foreshadowing or current shadowing of a whole bunch of things that have a much more impactful presentation being only explained in pictures. He offers readers information that they might want to know or that they can guess at, and it is honestly a really brilliant device. So he gives us all of these dreams where the reader can bear witness to things that confuse the characters, but totally make sense to us, at least potentially, depending on how good you are at speculating at stuff and how many times you've reread the series. So Egwene, as our preeminent dreamer, is just fumbling in the dark with her dreaming in this book. We get a handful of her dreams in the last book, where she just mentions them and that they trouble her, but in this one she's got fuck tons of them, almost none of which makes sense. But who cares? They're more for us anyway. We get this one a little bit later on in the story, at the point that the girls have been given their mission to hunt the Black Aja, and they have already left Tar Valon, and they're sailing down on their way to Tyr. It says, "Men and women breaking out of a cage, then putting on crowns, a woman playing with puppets, and another dream where the strings on puppets led to the hands of larger puppets, and their strings led to still greater puppets, on and on until the last strings vanished into unimaginable heights." So we get that quote in a chapter called Fires in Kaer Rhian. Up to that point in this book, we have seen Lanfear and Ishamael lurking around in dreams, specifically in Perrin's dreams, and we have had a glimpse of both Baelal and Raven, also in Perrin's dreams, and we've seen Lanfear in physical form creeping around the White Tower. But we're not yet aware in the narrative that there are three separate nations being ruled by the Forsaken. This dream in particular about the people putting on crowns shows us a lot about how Egwene's talent works. That's not a dream of the future, it's telling her what's going on right now in the narrative, and telling her what has happened in the recent past, because all of this has happened over the course of the winter. Raven, Samael, and Baelal were obviously stuffed deeper into the boar than Lanfear, who has been out since last summer. Maybe they've been out since the fall, and they spent a little bit of time learning the language or whatever. That's never explained how they learned the language, except that RJ was just kind of like, "Oh, it was really easy because it's so much simpler than the old tongue," which, whatever. Just don't worry about it, it's fine. Regardless, in each instance in Ilion, Tyr, and Caemlyn, it's mentioned that these three men showed up in the winter and rose to prominence, even though nobody has ever heard of them. So they got out a little bit later, either fall or winter. Lanfear has been creeping around fucking things up for probably 6 to 8 months before their release, and Ishamael has never been fully bound and has been released for years. So, as we watch our main characters attacked, deceived, trapped, and baited throughout the course of the story, It seems that on the surface, their utter destruction and the triumph of evil over them is this combined goal of the Dark One's bad lieutenants. But that can't be the case. It's not that simple. If that were the case, you would get some kind of cooperation among the Forsaken, and they would be good at it. Or at least they wouldn't be so terrible at it. It seems like the only reason that any of our main characters actually lives throughout the story is that the Dark One's lieutenants are not working together. They are not on each other's sides, everybody's motives are murky, and everyone has their own goals, and they're all maneuvering in the background. Before the story that is The Dragon Reborn, you had Aghanor and Balthamel show up for a hot minute, you have Ishamael being crazy and wanting Rand to serve him, and then maybe wanting him dead, and going back and forth about it, and you have Lanfear wanting Rand to love her and run away with her and rule the world. The latter two are working in the background. The first two get their 15 minutes of fame and freedom before dying for the first time, but no other Forsaken are free doing anything else in the world, at least as far as we know. So now we're at the point in the Wheel of Time within the story that is The Dragon Reborn, and we have Samael, and he's minding his own business at this point. He later becomes a relatively significant villain, at least throughout books 5, 6, and 7. He never does a whole lot that's truly important, except maybe sending the Shido all over the place to fuck everything up and let the Lord of Chaos rule, but he is a significant focus for Rand before he is killed at the end of Book 7. And then he's not even killed by Rand, he ends up getting grabbed by Mashadar, which I think is perfectly fine. I find it realistic to be like, oh, we went through all of this to try to kill you, and then you end up dying this ignominious death by being snagged by a murder mist when Rand wasn't looking. There seems to be a bit of truth to something like that. But in The Dragon Reborn, Samael's just doing his own thing in Ilion. He's not bothering Rand or the other boys, and he's not hanging out with any of the other Forsaken. You don't even see him. We wouldn't even know he was there if he hadn't sent the Darkhounds to spy on Moraine, Lon, Perrin, Loyal, and Faeil when they were in Ilion. That and the whole sense of foreboding, there's something terribly wrong in this city and everyone looks miserable thing. And it's never explained how it is that Moraine knows which Forsaken specifically is in Ilion, or how she knows that it is specifically Baelal when they're in Tyr, and I don't know that you could ever actually adequately explain that. Regardless, Samael is doing his own thing. Maybe he and Grendel are already scheming behind everyone's back, and that's just something happening off-screen that nobody knows about, but he's not bothering anyone yet, beyond the Ilioners, of course, by giving them sad dreams, because this is the book where the Forsaken make everyone in their cities have sad dreams, before RJ realized that the plot device of powerful channelers affecting those closely with their dreams was not practical or tenable and didn't make a lot of sense, and so he just forgot it was a thing. We know that Samael is not interacting with the other main Forsaken of the story because of things that we learn in Perrin's dreams. In Chapter 4, during the very first night that we're with Perrin, before the Trollocs attack the camp, Perrin goes to sleep, and he's dreaming. And it's never really made clear if this is the first time that he ends up in Tel Iron Riad. We know that he's had some concerning dreams, or he's concerned about his dreams in some way, because he's specifically stripping down and making sure his hut is freezing cold to prevent himself from sleeping too deeply. But it's never explained exactly why he started doing that, just that his dreams are dangerous for him. And we see this whole thing play out, either in a dream shard or in Tel Iron Riad, and the whole time he's got the wolves trying to wake him up to tell him that the Twisted Ones are coming. And he has visitations from both Ishamael and Lanfear, one right after the other, and they both offer him wine, but he's yelling no at the wolves in his head, and it lets him refuse the wine too. And then he ends up in a place that's similar to the ways, like the description that it gives of ramps and islands that are on top of each other is basically what it sounds like the ways are, and I think the fact that he can see them in this place and couldn't see in the ways, because the ways are dark obviously, keeps him from making the connection. But it makes sense that if they studied mirror worlds to get ideas for how they built the ways, maybe they also studied Tel Iron Riad, and maybe they just modeled it after that particular place because there's somehow like a shortening of distances or whatever. I think that may be why RJ decided to show the Forsaken gathering in that place, which I always think of as like an M.C. Escher picture. It says, cautiously peering over the top of the rail, he saw what he had seen moving. A flash of white flickered on a distant ramp. A woman, he was sure, though he could not quite make her out. A woman in a white dress, hurrying somewhere. On a bridge, slightly below him and much closer than the ramp where the woman had been, a man suddenly appeared, tall and dark and slender, the silver in his black hair giving him a distinguished look, his dark green coat thickly embroidered with golden leaves. Goldwork covered his belt and pouch, and gems sparkled on his dagger sheath, and golden fringe encircled his boot tops. Where had he come from? Another man started across the bridge from the other side, his appearance as sudden as the first man's. Black stripes ran down the puffy sleeves of his red coat, and pale lace hung thick at his collar and cuffs. His boots were so worked with silver that it was hard to see the leather. He was shorter than the man he went to meet, more stocky, with close-cropped hair as wide as his lace. Age did not make him frail, though. He strode with the same arrogant strength the other man showed. The two of them approached each other warily, like two horse traders who know the other fellow has a spav and mare to sell, Perrin thought. The men began to talk. Perrin strained his ears, but he could not hear so much as a murmur above the splashing echoes, frowns and glares and sharp motions as if half on the point of striking. They did not trust one another. He thought they might even hate each other. He glanced up, searching for the woman, but she was gone. When he looked back down, another man had joined the first two, and somehow, from somewhere, Perrin knew him, with the vagueness of an old memory, a handsome man in his middle years, wearing nearly black velvet and white lace. An inn, Perrin thought, and something before that, something a long time ago, it seemed, but the memory would not come. The first two men stood side by side now, made uncomfortable allies by the presence of the newcomer. He shouted at them and shook his fist while they shifted uneasily, refusing to meet his glares. If the two hated each other, they feared him more. His eyes, Perrin thought. What is strange about his eyes? The tall, dark man began to argue back, slowly at first, then with increasing fervor. The white-haired man joined in, and suddenly their temporary alliance broke. All three shouted at once, each at both of the others in turn. Abruptly, the man in dark velvets threw his arms wide as if demanding an end to it. So, the first two have to be Baelal and Raven. The Terran coat with the white hair is a dead giveaway for Baelal. When we meet him at the end of the book, he's described as having short white hair. And though Raven in this description is described as slender, and later on when Matt meets him, he's described as having almost Perrin shoulders, and when Nynaeve sees him at the end of the Fires of Heaven, he's described as being as tall as Rand, but thicker in the chest, it's Perrin's POV. And so I'm wondering if it's just a matter of skewed perception. My wife and I were discussing that. I was saying something to the effect of the Wheel of Time companion that says that Moraine is 5'4", but Rand always thinks of her as tiny, and my wife is like, well, it's Rand's point of view, and if he's really tall, then 5'4 would make her tiny. And I was like, oh, I'm going to make a point to pay attention throughout the books now about whether or not another person's perspective or how they see themselves affects their view of someone else. So maybe Perrin would actually think of Raven as being slender where no one else would, especially viewing him from a distance. The person has to be Raven. His coat is described as having gold leaves all over it, and when Matt goes to Camelin to drop Elaine's letter off and meets Gabriel, he's wearing a red coat with gold leaves all over it, so there's no one else that it could be. There's no sign of Samael here, but we know that he makes some manner of use of this weird M.C. Escher-like place, because when Moraine and everybody go to Ilion and they're easing the badger and she's talking to Nieda, her agent, and asking her, hey, what's new? And Nieda's talking about how Lord Brend has ascended the Council of Nine, but she has strange dreams of him. She says, dreams of Lord Brend in strange places and walking bridges hanging in air. All fogged these dreams do be, but near every night they do come. So we don't know what Raven and Baelal were arguing about, or what their uneasy alliance is, or why Shamael is screaming at them. We don't know why they're all shouting at each other, If I had to guess, I would think that Baylal and Raven are basically yelling at each other, stay in your lane, don't fuck with my business, or don't tell me what to do, or whatever. Baylal is called the Envious, so maybe he's envious of something that Raven is doing and he's being a dick about it? I don't know. I'm wondering if Ashamael, when he blows up at them, is like, I don't care what your beef is, you need to focus on killing Rand. But for whatever reason, Samael is not part of their little squabble here. And neither is Lanfear, she's just spying on it. Harren may have lost sight of her, but we know she didn't leave the meeting, and unlike him, she probably got close enough to hear what it was about. So, when Moraine and crew are in Ilion at easing the Badger, Samael sends Darkhounds to spy on them, and there's no way to know what alerted him to the presence of an Aes Sedai. Perrin is convinced that Samael sent the Darkhounds after him because he gets attacked by gray men in the common room of easing the Badger, and Moraine tells him he would not have sent both. I don't think Samael even knows you exist yet. I don't know how he figured out that an Aes Sedai was in the city. Who knows? Maybe RJ didn't worry about that at that point, but regardless, he sends the pack of Darkhounds after them to chase them out of the city. And Moraine even admits, we were probably just an annoyance to him. And that's about all that Samael does in this book. He does not get pulled into the fuckery and the general machinations that the other four Forsaken that we see in this book are all involved in. And it appears that Ashamael basically leaves him alone. And he may be doing other stuff behind the scenes that we don't see. He may be scheming with Grendel already, but whatever's going on with him, we are never privy to it. So, from what we can see in Perrin's dream, when he's hiding behind the railing in the Escher-like place that looks very like the Ways, Raven is afraid of Ashamael. And I'm thinking that that is partly just because Raven is a very patient and psychologically stable person with reasonable goals. He wants power, and to be nameless eventually, and to take time out from the pursuit of both things to be a gross, disgusting creep, often to the detriment of his other goals, at least according to the Wheel of Time companion and the Big White Book of Bad Art. But he still has basically stable, sensible goals that he wants to reach in a stable and sensible fashion. He's a cautious person who doesn't like to take risks, and so he finds Ashamael / Baalzamon irrational and unpredictable, and he doesn't want to deal with him. He's looking to build his own power and basically just kind of wait, sit back, and watch the others fight it out. He doesn't want to risk anything. You know, he's not a coward a la Mogedion where he wants to hide in the shadows, but he would much rather use diplomacy, set himself up to rule a powerful country, and let the other Forsaken pick each other off. Once there's a winnowing and he has a smaller field, and the time comes where he absolutely has to fight, then he'll fight. But not now. It's too soon. He doesn't have enough power yet. He only just started bringing his men into the Queen's Guards. He's just beginning the changing of the guard, as it were, where he'll gradually push all the loyal men out. He's still not in a great place, and he doesn't want to fight while he's tactically weak. So I'm wondering if Baylal got out of the boar sooner than Raven and Samael, and if he did that and then jumped on Tyr, because I'd imagine that Tyr would be the prime property for any male Forsaken the minute that they escape from the boar, because you would think that everyone wants Kalendor. But maybe that's not totally the case. I'm wondering if Raven purposefully picked Andor because Andor is the most powerful and stable nation, and because it's ruled by a single monarch, rather than Tyr, which has a whole bunch of high lords that have to share power and scheme together and against each other, or a place like Ilion that has both a king, a council of nine, and then the assemblage on top of that. So you've got the king, the lords that counterbalance him, and then the bunch of merchants and traders that act as a check against the power of the nosy nobles, as is represented by the king and the nine. When you have all of those people weighing in, it's just not as easy to rule, even with compulsion to help you out. Andor is a very powerful monarchy, so maybe Raven purposefully picked it. Maybe he decided to pass up Kalendor, figuring there was no way to get at it anyway, at least not until Rand drew it, and the danger involved in having the dragon come to you and welcoming him into the heart of your territory so he can draw out the thing that you long to steal from him, was just too much of a risk for too little a reward when there was a much more powerful, centrally located country available that was such easy prey. Because when he got there, Morghais was out of town. She was in Tarvalon, so he was able to either stir up trouble, cause whatever riots were happening in the winter, or else just capitalize on them and use them to gain power. Matt, when he leaves Tarvalon after being healed, travels to Camelin with Tom to deliver a letter for Elaine to her mother. It takes him 2 tries, the first time Gabriel's men on the front gates chase him off after they hear that he's from Tarvalon, so he drops his shit off at the inn, heads back to the palace, and goes over the garden wall. He comes back to the queen's blessing having delivered Elaine's letter to Morghais, and he asks Master Gil about Gabriel because he's overheard him telling his man Comar to kill Elaine. And it says, "Well, lad," Gil said, "there's not much to tell. He came out of the west during the winter, somewhere out your way, I think. Maybe it was the Two Rivers. I've heard the mountains mentioned." "We have no lords in the Two Rivers," Matt said. "Maybe there are some up around Barlon. I do not know." "That could be it, lad. I had never even heard of him before, but I do not keep up with the country lords. Came while Morghais was still in Tarvalon, he did, and half the city was afraid the tower was going to make her disappear, too. The other half did not want her back. The riots started up again, the way they did last year at the Tale of Winter." And then a little further down it says, "During the riots, he made himself leader of the faction supporting Morghais. Got himself wounded in the fighting, I hear, and by the time she returned, he had it all suppressed. Gareth Bryn didn't like Gabriel's methods. He can be a very hard man. But Morghais was so pleased to find order restored that she named him to the post Elida used to hold." So, Matt wants this information because he's trying to figure out why would Morghais's lover want Elaine dead? Would he be able to become King of Andor if Morghais's heir were dead and then she died too? And Gil's like, no. There's a hereditary monarchy and it's a matriarchy. There are only ever queens. And then RJ has Gil mention Lady Dailan and how she would be the next in line if both Morghais and Elaine died, which is another example of RJ introducing important characters long before we actually meet them. Just a great example of that. But it says, as Matt is sneaking through the garden trying to get the letter to the queen, he could hear voices from the window over his head, 2 men, just loud enough for him to make out the words, "On their way to Tyr, great master." The man sounded frightened and obsequious. "Let them ruin his plans if they can." This voice was deeper and stronger, a man used to command. "It will serve him right if 3 untrained girls can foil him. He was always a fool, and he is still a fool. Is there any word of the boy? He is the one who can destroy us all." "No, great master, he has vanished." "But, great master, one of the girls is Morghais's nit." Matt half turned, then caught himself. The soldiers were coming closer. They did not appear to have seen his start through the thickly woven rose stems. "Move, you fools! Get by so I can see who this man bloody is!" He had lost some of the conversation. "Has been far too impatient since regaining his freedom," the deep voice was saying. "He never realized the best plans take time to mature. He wants the world in a day, and Kalendor besides. The great lord take him. He may seize the girl and try to make use of her, and that might strain my own plans." "As you say, great master, shall I order her brought out of Tyr?" "No! The fool would take it as a move against him if he knew, and who can say what he chooses to watch aside from the sword? See that she dies quietly, Comar. Let her death attract no notice at all." His laughter was a rich rumble. "Those ignorant slatterns in their tower will have a difficult time producing her after this disappearance. This may all be just as well. Let it be done quickly. Quickly, before he has time to take her himself." So, RJ has done a really good job here of showing us that, no, indeed, the Forsaken are not allies. We haven't heard of Nablis or that the Dark One encourages competition between his highest lieutenants. We're not at that point yet. But we are seeing it here. He's showing and not telling us. And it's almost like Ravan is anticipating future conflict with Baelal. So while we don't know what they were arguing about in Perrin's dream, we know that there's beef between them. And here RJ is showing us that contention just with Ravan's unwillingness to provoke Baelal. He doesn't want to be seen moving in Tyr. He doesn't want Baelal to think for a second that he's trying to move against him. But at the same time, he's not about to give Baelal any kind of weapon or any leverage, and so he's like, he cannot have Elaine. I am not letting him have such a powerful tool that he can use against me to fuck with my plans. Go kill her. Don't let him take her. So we have no idea where Komar's intel comes from. We don't know whether Raven has Dark Friend spies in the tower, if they're specifically watching the girls, whether the Black Aja sends him news. There's no way to know exactly what's going on there. The only Forsaken that we know for sure has a specific interest in the girls is Ishamael. We know that he considers the girls important because he has both tried to get them out of the way and to kill them at this point. And then, Lanfear, of course, also has a specific interest in the girls because she wants to use them. Baelal, once the girls come to Tyr, snags them. But despite what they think, they were not lured there by Leandrin. They think that they were lured there by Leandrin, but instead they were baited into going there by Lanfear. And they more or less give themselves to the Black Aja by sending Julin Sandar to find the Black Sisters, which was kind of dumb since they were already waiting for them, and they knew that they were in Tyr because Egwene dream-bombed their meeting in Tel Iron Riad their first night, and then Leandrin is able to compel out of Julin his mission, using his ingrained belief that the High Lords can do no wrong in combination with the One Power. So she gets him to betray the girls, but Baelal only grabbed them because they practically delivered themselves to him. He wasn't expecting them there, and he wasn't looking for them. He didn't lure them or order them to be lured. They just kind of presented themselves, and so he was like, don't mind if I do. So, when it comes to the taunty dreams about Kalendor that are happening at the beginning of the story, Perrin's having dreams about Kalendor, Rand is complaining about taunting dreams about Kalendor. In the few POVs that we get from Rand, he's constantly thinking of Kalendor and the taunting and his dreams. One of the reasons that they've decided once Rand runs away that for sure, yeah, he's going after Kalendor is because once again, Perrin's been having dreams about it, and then everybody else in the camp, all the Shinarin soldiers, are having dreams about Kalendor. I can't make up my mind whether it's Baelal or Ishamael who is sending the taunty Kalendor dreams to Rand, and then whether Rand is just like a receiver for the dreams and then he broadcasts them to everyone else, or how that works, whether RJ had really figured that out, whether he was just deciding not to worry about it. Either way, it's not really anything that we ever hear about again. Baelal makes sense as being the one who sent the taunty dreams just because he's the one who wants Kalendor so badly. And we don't know how good a dreamer he is. You know, he could be a crack dreamer, and he could be able to find Rand and Tel Iron Riad no problem, find his dreams in the spaces between the pinpoint stars that Egwene likes to scoot around in, the ether where Gowan's dream finds her and they have dream sex. Baelal could be great at that, and he could be doing it, sending the dreams to Rand, or Ishi could be doing it. Because Rand's runaway note, when he's like, fuck it, I'm leaving, specifically says he is hunting me again, and this time one of us has to die, I think. So the Baal Zaman Ishamael hunty dreams could be separate from the Baelal Kalendor taunty dreams. It may be that two separate Forsaken are harassing Rand in two separate ways when he sleeps, or it could be that Ishamael is responsible for the Kalendor dreams, too. I'm wondering if Ishamael and Baelal are working together, or if Ishamael just wants Baelal to help him trap Rand in Tyr, or if he wants Baelal to distract Rand so that Ishamael can attack him from the shadows. I don't know, and I don't know that I'll ever be able to figure it out. It's too ambiguous, and no one else knows, and in the end, it's not really important. Moraine balefires Baelal out of existence, and when Rand kills Ishamael and he comes back as Moradin, he's at least a smidge saner and doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about what happened before. So, when Moraine and Lant learn that the High Lord Saemon is actually a Forsaken and Baelal is ruling in Tyr, Moraine asks Loial if he has any information because almost nothing is known about Baelal. He is the Forsaken that everybody forgets about. No wonder he's envious. It says, Jalanda, son of Ariad, son of Coim, wrote that he was called the Envious, that he forsook the light because he envied Luz Theron, and that he envied Ishamael and Lanfear, too. In a study of the War of the Shadow, Moylan, daughter of Hamada, daughter of Juindon, called Bela the Net Weaver, but I do not know why. She mentioned him playing a game of stones with Luz Theron and winning, and that he always boasted of it. So, if Baelal was working under Ishamael's orders, it's with anger and resentment and jealousy, and I am guessing that Ishamael never had any intention of letting Baelal near Kalendor. I think that if Baelal had managed to get Rand to take Kalendor instead of Rand being like, I don't trust that I'm the Dragon Reborn, and I'm going to fight him with the sword that I know instead of turning my back on him and going for this Sangreal that's only meant for one person. If Baelal had managed to kill Rand after Rand took Kalendor, I think that Ishamael would have immediately zorched him from behind, hit him with like, you know, some mini balefire or some lightning, whatever, before Baelal was able to even get a hold of Kalendor, so that Ishamael could have it instead. I think that Ishamael was just waiting in the wings to push Baelal under the bus, and I think that Moraine ruined his sneaky plan, which is why he zorched her instead, but didn't kill her. So, we don't know if Ishamael sent the Black Aja sisters, Leandrin and the rest of them, to Tyr to work for Baelal, or if Baelal conscripted them himself. We notice throughout the series that Dark Friends tend to work for whichever Forsaken lays claim to them, and it's like if you're working for one, you just want to cross your fingers and hope that another one doesn't want you to work for them. It's got to be like the worst management ever. It's like, well, that manager told me to do this, but now this manager is telling me to do that, and I've got to do what he says and hope that the other manager doesn't find out because I'll be in so much trouble, but I can't say no. Seriously, who would ever be a Dark Friend? Anyway, we know in The Great Hunt that Ishamael / Balzamon is controlling Leandrin, and he gave her her orders. Ishamael's interest at the point that Rand wounded him the first time at the end of the Eye of the World was to capitalize on any weaknesses that Rand had and separate him from his allies. He was like, okay, I want him to join me, and he said no, and he harmed me. I still want to get him to serve me. I haven't quite given up on that yet, but I need to hurt him, to weaken him. I know that he has buttons I can push. When I made him think that I was hurting Nynaeve and Egwene when we were in Tel Aaron Riad right before he melted my face and cut me off in the Dark One, he got super upset. Just like Luz Theron, this kid has vulnerabilities. He actually cares about people, and so I can play on those vulnerabilities. Balzamon knows that Egwene wants to protect Rand and actually makes a comment to him about the girl who's trying to protect you. And Rand is confused by that and actually is thinking to himself, is he talking about Moraine? She's not a girl. But Egwene has a mention in her inner narrative in The Great Hunt of having a dream where a man whose eyes are fire sees her and seems really shocked at seeing her. So he sees Egwene as a threat and also a source of both support and pain for Rand. So if he can harm her or separate her from him or both, then it weakens Rand, so he makes the choice that he'll send both Egwene and Nynaeve to the Seanchan. So he has Leandrin get rid of them and take them off to Tome and Head and pass them off to the High Lady Surath. And the goal was to send them back to Seanchan. It was flatly stated, Leandrin tells Surath, you need to take them to the other side of the ocean or it will be trouble. And I don't know if Semirash was out by that point. I don't know if she was already in Shandar at the Court of the Nine Moons pretending to be Anath Tuin's new truth speaker, and whether Ishamael was like, I'll send you a couple of Dimani, you know, a favor for a favor, or whether he just wanted them as far away as possible but didn't want to waste their power by killing them. I'm inclined to think Semirash wasn't out yet. If she was, I think Ishamael would have been totally healed instead of slowly growing new skin, probably by making some manner of use of the true power, unless he wouldn't have trusted her to heal him, which is perfectly reasonable. I mean, I wouldn't trust her. But Ishamael fails. He fails at his attempt to get rid of Rand's allies, and so after Falma, Egwene, Nynaeve, and Elaine are heading back to the tower, and maybe Leandrin and the others left to Tyr to go aid Baelal under Ishamael's orders, And he picked the Tarangriel that they end up stealing, the Dream Tarangriel and the Black Rod that makes Balefire and all the others that they steal. Maybe he was like, okay, steal this one and this one and those and then whichever else. Maybe that was his choice. He's like, you can't stay here anymore, Leandrin, so you and Rihanna and Chesmal and the rest need to fuck off out of here and go and aid another of the Chosen. Or maybe he just gave the orders to Alviarin and she delegated the task and chose who would go with Leandrin. Who knows? Regardless, once the girls get back to the tower, Ishamiel immediately chooses to kill them. We never are explicitly told under whose orders the attempts on the girls' lives are made, but it has to be Ishamiel. If we assume that the Grey Man who tried to kill Egwene and Nynaeve was sent by a Forsaken, which, who else would have done it? And if we further assume that it was sent by one of the five that we deal with in this book, it has to be Ishamiel. Samael does not know that the girls exist, and Robin is happy to have them alive and happy to have them tromping through Tyr and fucking up Baelal's plans. He's happy about it until he learns that Elaine is with them, and then he's like, I can't have Baelal stealing Elaine so that she can be an asset to him and aid him in fucking my shit up. Kill them all. Lanfear doesn't want them dead. She baits them and sends them off to Tyr to suit her own ends. Egwene has a dream about a woman playing with puppets, never realizing that she's one of the puppets. Baelal opportunistically captures them when they're in Tyr and was planning on turning them into dreadlords, so Ishamiel is the only Forsaken who would have had them killed. He couldn't ship them off to the Shansha, and that didn't work out, so he's finally like, okay, well, I tried to make use of them, but I'll just kill them instead. So, he tries to kill them first using a Grey Man, and I think that when Cheriam is coming up the ramp, and they're like, oh, we just found him here, I think she was coming up the ramp prepared to actually take care of their bodies, and the fact that they were just standing over the Grey Man instead, she was kind of like, oh, that was not what I was planning on dealing with here. The second time Ishamiel tries to have them killed is after they leave the White Tower. Along with the Shadows Assassins, he's got regular Dark Friends going after the girls. The sunken boat that stops the girls' ship in the Arranon was likely put there by brigands purposefully to target their vessel, and then the brigands capture them to sell to the Murdrel, who are specifically looking for them. I think that he's trying to get rid of the girls because they care so deeply about Rand and want to help him, and Ishamiel does not want him having any kind of support in the White Tower, even the support of young women whose power and influence he dismisses with such contempt. Ishamiel is trying to clear the board of Rand's allies. He's got Grey Men eventually catching up with Perrin in Ilion. He's got people tracking Matt. He sends out Dark Friends and Grey Men in force, mostly to try to kill Matt. He tries to kill Perrin maybe once, but damn, does he ever try to kill Matt. And Matt is convinced that everybody's trying to kill him because of the letter that Elaine gave him, and it's like, no, Matt, no. They're specifically trying to kill you. But before he's sending out his minions, Ishamiel is working on Matt and Perrin in other ways. The first time that we see him in this book, we see him in Chapter 4, before Perrin's dream switches to where they're in the Escher-esque place that looks like the Ways, Ishamiel is trying to persuade Perrin rather than to kill him. It says, "So you will give it up then. It is the best thing for you. Come, sit and we will talk." Perrin turned to look at the speaker. The round tables scattered about the room were empty except for the lone man seated in the corner in the shadows. The rest of the room seemed in some way hazy, almost an impression rather than a place, especially anything he was not looking at directly. He glanced back at the fire. It burned on a brick hearth now. Somehow none of it bothered him. It should, but he could not have said why. The man beckoned and Perrin walked closer to his table. A square table. The tables were square. Frowning, he reached out to finger the tabletop, but pulled his hand back. There were no lamps in that corner of the room, and despite the light elsewhere, the man and his table were almost hidden, nearly blended with the dimness. Perrin had a feeling that he knew the man, but it was as vague as what he saw out of the corner of his eye. The fellow was in his middle years, handsome and too well-dressed for a country inn, in dark, nearly black velvets, with white lace falls at his collar and cuffs. He sat stiffly, sometimes pressing a hand to his chest as if moving hurt him. His dark eyes were fixed on Perrin's face. They appeared like glistening points in the shadows. "Give up what?" Perrin asked. "That, of course." The man nodded to the axe at Perrin's waist. He sounded surprised, as if it were a conversation they had had before, an old argument taken up again. Perrin had not realized the axe was there, had not felt the weight of it pulling at his belt. He ran a hand over the half-moon blade and the thick spike that balanced it. The steel felt solid, more solid than anything else there, maybe even more solid than he was himself. He kept his hand there to hold on to something real. "I have thought of it," he said, "but I do not think I can. Not yet." "Not yet?" The inn seemed to flicker, and the murmur sounded again in his head. "No." The murmur faded. "No?" The man smiled, a cold smile. "You are a blacksmith, boy, and a good one, from what I hear. Your hands were made for a hammer, not an axe. Made to make things, not to kill. Go back to that before it is too late." Perrin found himself nodding. "Yes, but I'm Tavirin." He had never said that out loud before, but he knows it already. He was sure of that, though he could not say why. For an instant, the man's smile became a grimace, but then it returned in more strength than before, a cold strength. "There are ways to change things, boy. Ways to avoid even fate. Sit, and we will talk of them." The shadows appeared to shift and thicken, to reach out. Perrin took a step back, keeping well in the light. "I don't think so. At least have a drink with me. To years past and years to come. Here, you will see things more clearly after." The cup the man pushed across the table had not been there a moment before. It shone bright silver, and dark blood-red wine filled it to the brim. Perrin peered at the man's face. Even to his sharp eyes, the shadows seemed to shroud the other man's features like a warder's cloak. Darkness molded the man like a caress. There was something about the man's eyes, something he thought he could remember if he tried hard enough. The murmur returned. "No," he said. He spoke to the soft sound inside his head, but when the man's mouth tightened in anger, a flash of rage suppressed as soon as begun, he decided it would do for the wine as well. "I'm not thirsty." He turned and started for the door. The fireplace was rounded river stones. A few long tables lined by benches filled the room. He suddenly wanted to be outside, anywhere away from this man. "You will not have many chances," the man said behind him in a hard voice. "Three threads woven together share one another's doom. When one is cut, all are. Fate can kill you if it does not do worse." So, basically, telling him, "Ditch Rand, you know you want to. And here, have a drink." We never get a clear-cut dream from Matt with his chamail in it. But when he first wakes after being healed, we do get this. He had been dreaming, and bits of those dreams still tumbled together with memories in his head. He could not separate one from the other. Wild flights and fights, strange people from across the ocean, waves and portal stones and pieces of other lives, things right out of a Gleeman's tales. These had to be dreams. At least he thought they must be. But Loyal was no dream, and he was an Ogier. Chunks of conversations drifted around in his thoughts. Talks with his father, with friends, with Moraine, and a beautiful woman, and a ship captain, and a well-dressed man who spoke to him like a father giving sage advice. Those were probably real, but it was all bits and fragments, drifting. So, I think the well-dressed man is Ishamael, and that it is a dream. But Ishamael probably picked a poor time to be stalking Matt's dreams, considering how fucked Matt's memories are because of the shattered Logoth dagger. Nothing really stuck or made an impression, at least on the surface. But who knows what stuck beneath the surface? It seems like so much with Matt is beneath the surface, because if what Ishamael was telling him was something to the effect of, "Look after yourself, you know, you should just go see the world. There's nothing you can do for Rand. You really just need to take care of yourself." That's kind of what you hear out of Matt when he first wakes up. He's telling himself, "I can't help Rand. I'm the only sane person left. Perrin's been weird since his eyes got funny, and Rand's off playing at being the Dragon Reborn. I have to look out for me." So that could be Matt being Matt, or that could be part of what he was hearing from his Shamiel in his dreams. And who knows, I mean, maybe Matt had some wine. Or maybe Matt told him to fuck off, because the Shamiel hedges his bets really fast, and the minute that Matt goes to leave Tar Valon, Ishi's minions are trying to kill him. And because Perrin told him no, too, I'm wondering if he lost track of Perrin right away, or if he got distracted going after Rand, or whatever, because he doesn't try to kill Perrin until Moraine and crew get to Ilion, and somehow Ishamiel manages to find him there. So I don't know why it took him so long to track Perrin down, or whether narratively it was just easier for RJ to wait and only have a couple of his characters be constantly having murderers after them, which is understandable. But the Murkrel who tries to kill Perrin when the Twisted Ones attack the camp at the beginning of the story says it best. The Murkrel says to him, "Cut one leg of the tripod and all fall down." Ishamiel is done fucking around with these three. His attempts to convert Rand have been so much hubris, and he is frustrated and pissed. So, in Perrin's dreams at the beginning of the book, we see Ishamiel bullying and intimidating Baelal and Raven. And in a later dream on the boat, as they're fleeing Bremen, we see him being really confrontational with Lanfear. But he's not very good at bullying her. It says, "For a moment, Balzamon stood alone. Then suddenly there was a woman with him, clad all in white and silver. Shock hit Perrin. He could never forget a woman so beautiful. She was the woman from his dream, the one who had urged him to glory. An ornate silver throne appeared behind her, and she sat, carefully arranging her silken skirts. 'You make free use of my domain,' she said. 'Your domain,' Balzamon said. 'You claim it yours, then? Do you no longer serve the great lord of the dark?' The darkness around him thickened for an instant, seemed to boil. 'I serve,' she said quickly. 'I have served the lord of the twilight long. Long did I lie imprisoned for my service in an endless, dreamless sleep. Only grey men and murderers are denied dreams. Even Trollocs can dream. Dreams were always mine, to use and walk. Now I am free again, and I will use what is mine.' 'What is yours?' Balzamon said. The blackness swirling round him seemed mirthful. 'You always thought yourself greater than you were, Lanfear.' The name cut at Perrin like a newly honed knife. One of the Forsaken had been in his dreams. Moraine had been right. Some of them were free. The woman in white was on her feet, the throne gone. 'I am as great as I am. What have your plans come to? 3,000 years and more of whispering in ears and pulling the strings of throned puppets like an Aes Sedai.' Her voice invested the name with all scorn. 3,000 years, and yet Luce Theron walks the world again, and these Aes Sedai all but have him leashed. Can you control him? Can you turn him? He was mine before ever that straw-haired chit Ilyena saw him. He will be mine again. Do you serve yourself now, Lanfear?" Balzamon's voice was soft, but flame raged continuously in his eyes and mouth. "Have you abandoned your oaths to the great lord of the dark?" For an instant the darkness nearly obliterated him, only the glowing fire showing through. "They are not so easily broken as the oaths to the light you forsook, proclaiming your new master in the very hall of the servants. Your master claims you forever, Lanfear. Will you serve, or do you choose an eternity of pain, of endless dying without release?" "I serve." Despite her words, she stood tall and defiant. "I serve the great lord of the dark, and none other, forever." So, Lanfear bends at the end, sort of, but you get the impression that she's going through the motions, and Perrin certainly senses her defiance. In the earlier dream that he references, where he's like, "She was in my dreams, back in the mountains," she shows up after he tells Ishamiel no. He tells him, "I don't want your wine, I don't want to sit and talk to you, and I'm gonna go. Yeah, I'd like to be a blacksmith, but you know what? I'm Tavirin. I'm not interested in what you have to say, and I gotta go." And Lanfear plays the glory card, just like she does with Rand. When Rand gets the Horn of Valyr back, or even before he takes it back, when she comes up to him in the mirror world being like, you must rescue me. I'm a damsel in distress. And she's like, oh, how glad I'll be to stand beside the one who has all the glory and who will hold the horn, because she's all about the glory, which other people just don't seem to value. I don't know. I mean, maybe that's just an old-fashioned value, and kids these days, they have no respect for glory. Fucking kids. But when Lanfear shows up after Perrin fucks off from talking to Baalzamon, the dream changes. He's looking in a mirror. He has a golden helmet with a lion's head on it, and he's basically like, I'm a blacksmith, this isn't mine. And she says, you must not listen to those who would try to turn you from your destiny. They would demean you, debase you, destroy you. Fighting fate can only bring pain. Why choose pain when you can have glory, when your name can be remembered alongside all the heroes of legend? So, she's trying to counteract Ishamael's influence here. I don't know if she was lurking in the wings, waiting for Ishi to fuck off out of Perrin's dream, but the minute he's gone, she's there. Ishamael tells Perrin, you don't want to do this anymore, you want to go home and be a blacksmith, and she's just like, shh, don't listen to him, don't listen to him. You know you want to be glorious and awesome, because she doesn't want Rand's allies to desert him, and so that's why she's doing whatever she can to work in opposition to Ishamael. Lanfear saves Rand's life in the Great Hunt. At the end of the book, Min finds him and drags him into a house. He's horribly wounded because Baalzamon stabbed him in the side, and he's dying. And Min even comments on it when he wakes up that he would have died, and Nynaeve must have done something to help him before Moraine got to him, and Nynaeve said that she didn't, that she was too scared to channel. But Lanfear comes in while Min is lying in bed with him and keeping him warm, and she touches his forehead and draws something that looks like the dragon's fang. So Lanfear heals him. He would have died otherwise, and she wants him to live. She wants Rand to win and triumph and be hers. And so she spends the dragon reborn countering Ishamael's efforts while trying not to be obvious about it. So she's telling him to his face, oh, I totally serve. I'm totally on your side. Yeah, bro, we got the same goal. And then right behind his back, she's being like, don't listen to him. Don't leave your friend. You want to be glorious, because she doesn't understand Perrin, and she values completely different things. She doesn't know what to appeal to. If she had said to him, hey, your friend needs you, if she had appealed to loyalty or duty, that would have been far more persuasive to Perrin than glory. But fortunately, Perrin doesn't need Lanfear to tell him to resist Ishamael. But nonetheless, she works on Perrin because she wants Rand's allies to be there for him and to help him out so that the other Forsaken cannot kill him, because that's not what she wants. She wants to clear the field of Forsaken and have a whole bunch of them die off before the Day of Return, in much the same way that Robin does. Robin wants to hang out in Camelon and engage in political schemes and let everyone else fight and die off. Lanfear wants people to die off too, but she wants Rand to be living at the end. And I'm sure she is sick of Ishamael, sick of his crazy, sick of his bullshit, and sick of having to dance around his temper because he's technically in charge. So she works on Perrin, and then she visits the White Tower where she lays the bait to direct the girls to Tyr. But before she does that, she drops in on Matt, who is just awakened from being healed. She introduces herself as Selene, and she says, I'm someone whose interests coincide with yours. These Aes Sedai mean to use you, but you will like it in the main, I think, and accept it. There is no need to convince you to seek out glory. Use me. The memory returned to him of thinking that, but about Rand, that the Aes Sedai meant to use Rand, not him. They've no bloody use for me. Light they can't have. What do you mean? I'm no one important. I am no use to anyone but myself. What kind of glory? I knew that would pull you. You above all. Her smile made his head spin. He scrubbed a hand through his hair. The blanket slipped and he caught it hastily before it could fall. Now listen, they are not interested in me. What about me sounding the horn? I am just a farmer. Maybe they think I'm tied to Rand in some way. No, Varen said... He was not sure what Varen had said or Moraine, but he thought most Aes Sedai knew nothing at all about Rand. he wanted to keep it that way, at least until he was a long way gone. Just a simple country man. I only want to see a little of the world and go back to my dad's farm. What does she mean, Glory? Celine shook her head as if she had heard his thoughts. You are more important than you yet know. Certainly more important than these so-called Aes Sedai know. You can have Glory, if you know enough not to trust them. You certainly sound as if you don't trust them. So-called. A thought came to him, but he could not manage to say it. Are you... It was not the kind of thing you accuse someone of. A dark friend? Celine said mockingly. She sounded amused, not angered. She sounded contemptuous. One of those pathetic followers of Balzamon who think he will give them immortality and power? I follow no one. There is one man I could stand beside, but I do not follow. Matt laughed nervously. Of course not. Blood and ashes, a dark friend wouldn't name herself dark friend. Probably has a poison knife if she is. He had a vague memory of a woman dressed as one nobly born, a dark friend with a deadly dagger in her slender hand. That wasn't what I meant at all. You look like a queen. That was what I meant. Are you a lady? Matt, you must learn to trust me. Oh, I will use you too. You have too suspicious a nature, especially since carrying that dagger, for me to deny it. But my use will gain you wealth and power and glory. I will not compel you. I've always believed men perform better if convinced rather than forced. These Aes Sedai do not even realize how important you are, and he will try to dissuade or kill you, but I can give you what you desire. He, Matt said sharply, kill me. Light, it's Rand they were after, not me. How does she know about the dagger? I suppose the whole tower knows. Who wants to kill me? Celine's mouth tightened as if she had said too much. You know what you want, Matt, and I know it every bit as well as you. You must choose who you will trust to gain it for you. I admit I will use you. These Aes Sedai will never do that. I will lead you to wealth and glory. They will keep you tied to a leash until you die. You say a lot, Matt said, but how do I know any of it is true? How do I know I can trust you any more than I can them? So she gives Matt a heads up so he is wary. So that he's wary of Baalzamon and of the Aes Sedai. And perhaps not intentionally, but she makes sure that he's wary of her as well. But her ultimate goal is to keep him aware and alive and in the game, because she knows that he's important to the overall fight, and she knows that he's important to Rand. She's not an idiot. She was a scholar in the Age of Legends, and for her to see that this turning of the wheel, or this iteration of the dragon being reborn, that there are two other Tavirin with him, she has to know that that is seriously important, and that those two allies are going to be a major component of Rand's ability to come out on top, and so she wants all of Rand's allies ready and available to help him. She's been creeping around the tower, and she's been getting intel and learning about the girl's mission, just listening in and being able to make use of inverted weaves and folded lights or her mask of mirrors, and I'm wondering if Masana either is not out yet or at least hasn't come to the tower yet. I know that she shows up and is able to infiltrate the way she does because she looks similar to another sister named Danelle. And because Elida doesn't start planning the coup for another couple of months at least, I think that Masana probably doesn't show up in the White Tower until after the girls leave. Otherwise, Lanfear would not have been able to creep around with such impunity. Or maybe she would. It's not like she cares about boundaries. Lanfear has such contempt for Aes Sedai that I'm guessing she barely makes use of the Black Aja. I'll bet she taps some of them to lay the bait in the basement, all the clothes and the other scraps, the clues, Leandrin, and the others supposedly left behind to say, hey, we went to Tyr. Once she's taken care of having the bait laid, which, I don't know, maybe she did it by herself. She visits Matt in the night, and then the following day she goes dressed as Elsa Grinwell to lure the girls in. It says from Egwene's point of view, as they're puzzling over the paperwork that Varen gave her with all of the information about the 13 Black Sisters, it says, She became aware of a woman standing in the doorway, a woman in novice white with her hair in long braids. "Did no one ever teach you to knock, Elsa?" Nynaeve said. Egwene hid the stone ring inside her fist. She had the strangest feeling that Elsa had been staring at it. So, they're discussing making use of the stone ring Tirangriel that Varen has given Egwene, and Lanfear comes to their room and opens the door to say, "Hey yo, here's my bait for this trap that I want to send you down to Tyr for." We get this bit from Perrin one night when he's dreaming adventures into Tel Iron Riad. It says, "A darkness formed among the clouds, a hole into somewhere else. Egwene and Nynaeve and Elaine stood looking at a huge metal cage with a raised door held on a heavy spring. They stepped in and reached up together to loose the catch. The barred door snapped down behind them. A woman with her hair all in braids laughed at them, and another woman all in white laughed at her." I don't think it's that Lanfear wants the girls to be captured or harmed or anything in particular. I don't know that she cares what happens to them at all. In fact, I doubt it. She just knows what their mission is, and she wants to send them to Tyr because she wants Rand's allies to be in Tyr, and she wants to fuck up the other Forsaken's plans. So anything she can do to stir the pot, she's there to do it. I also think that she wants to specifically fuck up Ishamael's plans, and she knows that Ishamael wants the girls dead, and she does not want Rand's allies killed, certainly not before they can be of use to her. And so she's kind of like, "I'm going to get them out of the tower, because he'll probably try to kill them again." Lanfear sees the stone ring, the dream Tirangriel, in Egwene's hand, and Lanfear, being a master of Tel Iron Riad, is like, So she walks away, and Egwene chases her down, thinking she's chasing Elsa Grinwell. Lanfear has gotten out of sight, so that when Egwene catches up to her, instead of seeing Elsa, she sees Lanfear in her true form. And Egwene is feeling all awkward and dirty, and I've always wondered, because beauty is not objective, if the combs that Lanfear wears in her hair and her belt buckle are Tirangriel that are designed to, like, affect people's moods or desires and make men want you and women want to be you or some bullshit like that, I don't know. It just seems highly unlikely that everyone would think she was the most gorgeous thing ever, and the fact that women think specific things around her and think of themselves as less cannot be natural. Regardless, Egwene runs up to her, and Lanfear basically says to her, "You're really bold to go running around where so many murders have done," and sounds super pleased about it. She's pleased because the girls are so ripe to be baited. And she also knows, okay, this girl is going to go into Tel Iron Riad, and I will be able to direct her, and it will be easy as pie to get them to Tyr. And it is. She approaches Egwene as her, like, wise woman guide in Tel Iron Riad. She's old Sylvie. Egwene ends up in the heart of the stone, and it says, Sylvie was hobbling toward the crystal sword. "Plots," she said as if to herself. "All of them pretending to serve the great lord, and all the while plotting and planning to regain what they lost. Each one thinking he or she is the only one plotting. Ishamael is a fool." "What?" Egwene said sharply. "What did you say about Ishamael?" The old woman turned to present a crooked, ingratiating smile. "Just a thing poor folks say, my lady. It earns the Forsaken's power, calling them fools. Makes you feel good and safe. Even the shadow can't take being called a fool. Try it, my lady. Say Baalzamon is a fool." Egwene's lips twitched on the edge of a smile. "Baalzamon is a fool. You're right, Sylvie." It actually did feel good laughing at the Dark One. The old woman chuckled. The sword revolved just beyond her shoulder. "Sylvie, what is that?" "Kalendor, my lady. You know that, don't you? The sword that cannot be touched." Abruptly, she swung her stick behind her. A foot from the sword, the stick stopped with a dull thwack and bounded back. Sylvie grinned wider. "The sword that is not a sword, though there's precious few knows what it is. But none can touch it save one. They saw to that who put it here. The dragon reborn will hold Kalendor one day and prove to the world he's the dragon by doing it. The first proof, anyway. Loose Theron come back for all the world to see and grovel before. Ah, the High Lords don't like having it here. They like nothing to do with the power. They'd rid themselves of it if they could. If they could. I suppose there's others would take it if they could. What wouldn't one of the Forsaken give to hold Kalendor? So, Lanfear tells a bold Black Aja hunter, the Forsaken and Tyr want Kalendor. She plants all of the clues, and she gives them an intense sense of urgency and this desire to help Rand. And like I said, I don't think she had a specific purpose. She's just sending more allies and more people that can make Baelal's life more difficult, that can make Ishamael's life more difficult. She just wants to make sure that Rand is the one who ends up with Kalendor. And I think in her mind, if Ishamael can end up dead too, like really, really dead this time, that's all the better. I think she feels like Ishamael is a liability. She broke character a bit as Sylvie talking to Egwene, and some of her frustration poured out. She thinks he's a fool. He's crazy. He doesn't think rationally, and frankly, Lanfear is not someone who can complain about another person's rationality, but at the point that she has any cause to, you know that a Forsaken is not doing so great in their ability to reason. So I think she's over it. She's over dealing with him. She thinks he's an idiot and that his desires are not compatible with hers. It would be one thing if he had managed to convert Rand and get him to serve, but even then, I don't think that she would like that very much. She doesn't want Rand to serve Ishamael. She wants Rand to serve her, or at least, no, it counts as serving her. Even if she stands beside him, she always wants him to be the subservient one because she felt like she was the one led around by the nose by Luce Theron, and she didn't like it. Perhaps because Ishamael was used to being in charge, used to being obeyed, and he had the other male Forsaken work with him or work for him at least to some degree, I don't think he realized how much Lanfear was undermining him. And neither did I. Once again, doing this podcast has forced me to look closer at these books and really ask myself, what's going on here? So I started simply just trying to figure out, wait, who's sending the dreams of Kalendor? Is it Ishamael? Is it Baelal? And in the end, I was like, I don't know that it really matters, because looking at the ultimate goal, I think the ultimate goal overall of the Forsaken fuckery here is simply Lanfear is trying to circumvent Ishamael's goals. Lanfear is trying to keep Rand's allies alive. Lanfear is trying to get everybody to Tyr so that Rand has the help that he needs, so that Rand has the support that he needs, so that Rand can proclaim himself as the dragon and have the glory and have Kalendor and be someone worthy for her to stand beside. Because she doesn't come back for him at the end of the Great Hunt. And even at the end of The Dragon Reborn, she just leaves a note being like, yeah, tend him until I come for him. Basically, like, let's have him gain some more prestige and get his shit together a little bit more, and then I'll come for him. And in the meantime, I think she's probably getting Asmodean together because she knows that Rand is going to need a teacher. So for all of her reasons, you know, whatever they are, all on her own, working in the background to help him triumph and to keep his friends there to help him out. And that's honestly kind of awesome. Lanfear is such an exciting villain, and the exposure to the Forsaken that we get in this book is so interesting. And whatever Lanfear's reasons for doing what she does, you know, none of it stops her from being a creep. Because in the end, you're talking about this naive 20-year-old virgin that she wants to dominate, which is creepy. But when it comes to this whole story arc of evil people who technically serve the same master, but are as much each other's enemies as they are our heroes' enemies, and whose motivations are so murky, this book is the first book where the Forsaken really start to get interesting, and it only progresses from here. And so I'm interested to continue to explore throughout the rest of the series what just might end up being a regular segment called Forsaken Fuckery, because the light knows there's a lot of it. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Podcast of the Dragon. This one was so much fun. I loved it, and I look forward to doing more episodes about Forsaken Fuckery. You can find me on Twitter at WarderGray. That's Gray with an E.
There are links down in the show notes for my Patreon if you want to go there and help me out and have some access to great bonus content. For Discord, email. If you would like to see me on the Wheel of Time Spoilers Tangents of Chaos, there is a link to the YouTube video as well as to the regular podcast episode. And also yesterday I was on the Way of the Leafs Tavern Talk again, so there is also a link to that YouTube video as well. If you would rate and review my show, particularly on iTunes or Apple Music or whatever the hell it's called, I would really, really appreciate that. That would help me out a lot. And if you have a friend that likes the Wheel of Time and is familiar with the series and would like a different type of podcast to listen to, you tell them about me. That would be cool. My music is by Kevin MacLeod. I'm the Grey Warder. And I know that Lanfear's method of placating Ishamael to his face and then doing whatever the hell she wants behind his back while talking mad shit about him and working hard to undermine him is a very effective strategy to deal with any kind of asshole boss, whether or not his eyes are made of fire.